Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. This is a special program for me because after 2.5 years, this is the final All Together Now segment I'll be hosting. I've really enjoyed this whole project, and I've learned so much from my guests, but other projects are beckoning now, so more about that at the end of the hour. Our focus today is going to be the big teach-in that will take place in New York next month on techno-utopianism and the fate of the Earth. It will be held in the Great Hall at Cooper Union on October 25th and 26th. And this teach-in is a project of the International Forum on Globalization in collaboration with the International Center for Technology Assessment, the New York Open Center, and the Schumacher Center for New Economics. I have two guests today, both associated with the teach-in. The first one is a co-organizer of the event, Jerry Mander, who will give us an overview of what will be presented. Then in the second half of the program, I'll have a conversation with Dr. Helen Caldicott, who's one of the speakers at the teach-in, and she'll give us a preview of what she'll be presenting there. So, my first guest, Jerry Mander, is an author, an eco-social critic, and besides being co-organizer of the teach-in, he's a co-founder and he's the co-chair of the board of directors of one of the organizations sponsoring it, the International Forum on Globalization. Visit their website, by the way, for information about the teach-in. That's ifg.org. Jerry Mander is also the former program director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology, and he was the founder and executive director of the Public Media Center, which was a very important public interest ad agency in San Francisco for 3 decades. He's the author of several books, 4 Arguments for the Elimination of Television, and In the Absence of the Sacred, and his most recent book, The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. He's also co-edited 3 very substantive anthologies, The Case Against the Global Economy, and 4, A Turn Toward the Local, and Alternatives to Economic Globalization, A Better World is Possible, and Paradigm Wars, Indigenous Peoples' Resistance to Globalization. Jerry Mander, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Charlene. Thanks so much.
I recently came across a piece of paper in my files that I apparently photostated out of your book, In the Absence of the Sacred. It's the page 10 Recommended Attitudes About Technology. I think I used to distribute this to a lot of people. And I was looking at it since it was published in 1991. And you said, I offer this little list of reminders because I keep it printed above my desk to remind myself of appropriate attitudes. And some of them were, here's one, since most of what we're told about new technology comes from its proponents, well, of course, and its marketing departments, be deeply skeptical of all claims. And then eschew the idea that technology is neutral or value-free. Every technology has inherent and identifiable social, political, and environmental consequences. And then you say the fact that technology has a natural flash and appeal is meaningless because the negative attributes are slow to emerge. So I'm just wondering, lo, these many years later, that all seems so common sense and wise at the time when I read it. Since you once used to write marketing ads yourself, what's your perspective on why it's so difficult for an evidence-based critique of aspects of technology to get any traction?
Question of the domination of the information field by people who have whose primary interest is in convincing us of a certain worldview and a certain desire to buy their products or accept their except their virtues. I was following recently the GMO battle that we will discuss at the teach-in genetically modified food, and recently there was a fierce attack on a couple of GMO anti-GMO battlers, individuals, and about some overstatements they made or some things that were that the attackers felt were wrong. The attackers, by the way, are Monsanto Corporation and DuPont and Dow Chemical. And these are companies that spend, you know, collectively, Monsanto itself spends $410 million over the last 4 years in putting out messages that are difficult to counter because nobody has that kind of money to counter it. And so the general public is receiving $400 million worth of imagery purveying a certain viewpoint and a certain worldview and a certain idea about technology and a certain willing and a certain critique of those people who, without the benefit of advertising, are trying to resist technology or point out some problems with it. And it's such a domination of information that is very, very difficult to overcome. Of course, I write a lot about how advertising has power that most people don't really recognize. In other words, I was in the advertising business, the commercial advertising business, for a while, and then in the nonprofit advertising business. And I was one of the things that really impressed me was the strength of advertising. In other words, the ability of advertising to dominate consciousness, that once that you put out hundreds of millions of dollars worth of imagery, and that goes into people's brains all over the place, and once in, it doesn't go out again. And the only way to counter it really is with battling back with as many ideas and images as you can put back once you live inside that world.
Yeah, so I remember you're saying that. I just want to break in. You're saying that early on, and you said it doesn't matter if you take a hip, ironic posture toward the thing and say, "Oh, I know, they're just trying to get me to buy something. You know, I'm above this," because once the image is in your brain, it's there. That was so.
Yeah, I know. You walk around with it, and people don't even know. You know, I sometimes mention the Taco Bell Chihuahua. To people, and then I say, "Do you have a picture of it in your head now?" And and they almost always do if they've ever seen the commercials. They're a little old now, I know. But nobody knows they're carrying that image around. And, that, you know, you're carrying all those images around. They don't go away. And the domination of media by a very small number of corporations, mass media, seven corporations now control 75% of all global media. That's maybe the most shocking figure of all time. And they're putting out basically, even though they're advertising different things and they're telling different stories some of the time, they're putting out a basic worldview about how life is commodity and how we'll all do better if we buy this and that and how we really ought to love technological change and corporations are good and so on. And there's no counter voice to that, if that's the degree, except for you, Shirley.
And a lot of people who will be at the teach-in. But I just want to say you've really identified two separate issues. I mean, one is there's not the money on the side of people pointing out the problems to in any way have the same effect of the people creating and selling the problematic products. But the second one is even to get people to understand the proportionate difference in those two. You know, the public is so unaware that this is a vast expenditure versus these little nonprofits trying to get a word in.
I know, and then the media deals with them as though they're equal players, and they're trying to be equal players, but they're they're really, really not. You know, when mass media is purveying these gigantic number of. And also the media itself is owned by these same companies that are doing the advertising, or similar ones.
It's a unified
worldview, in, whether it's in the, I mean, it's slightly different if it's in the ads than in the text of the newspaper or on the Internet and so on, and you get some variation sometimes on the Internet, but it's, the point is that we're living in a world of pre-created ideas that we have all slowly over years, or not so slowly, over the last half century anyway, ingested and has become a dominant worldview. And so it makes it very easy for new, highly doubtful technologies to be introduced and to seem normal. And, redesigning vegetables so that they become sort of techno vegetables,
right?
Seems perfectly normal to people, you know. And if we have climate change, then redesigning the skies, you know, putting various chemicals up into the skies to change the skies so that we'll resist sunlight a little bit more, and then you're living with those techno skies, seems perfectly normal and acceptable, redesign the molecular structures of the planet to make it more efficient for various activities. Nanotechnology is all the radiation that we live in. You know, in this event, we're going to have a panel on radiation soup. You know, the fact that there's just thousands of kinds of radiation now that we're all living inside of, none of which have been verified to be healthy, and many of which have been verified to be unhealthy.
That's right.
And these are just a few examples of the individual subjects that that we hope to take up in this event, and that we will take up in this event. Now we hope to make an impression.
Well, let's move into that. I would like you to just give a general sense to my listeners of what's going to happen. Again, this teach-in is entitled Techno-Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth. It's going to be held at Cooper Union in New York on October 25th and 6th. The first day, it's not structured like a regular conference that breaks for dinner or lunch. You know, you just drop in and drop out, you know, and hear the things you want to hear and go out and get some food and come back. So the first day it goes from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., and the second day it goes from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
It's actually 7 p.m. We extended it a little bit.
Oh, you extended it a little bit. Okay.
7 p.m.
But anyway, people can buy tickets ahead of time, and it's a very minimal cost. What, about $35 in New York?
Well,
they can get it at the New York Open Center.
If you're a senior or a student, it's only going to be $15 a day, I think, is what the rate is.
Okay.
The most expensive ticket is $75 for both days, so no matter what you do,
it's not
expensive.
For both days together,
yeah.
And they can get it at the Open Center or where?
Brown paper tickets is what a lot of people like to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, do I have the phone number? You want me to give the 800-838-3006.
Okay, great.
That's Brown Paper Tickets. That's an agency that just sells tickets for it.
Let's start in Saturday morning, if people show up, Saturday, October 25th. Part one is technology versus nature. What's the thematic
Well, we're just going to try to set the frameworks for discussing. You know, there's a lot of discussion of technology, but almost always it's in terms of, how does it affect wealth, and how does it distort wealth, and social justice effects, and so on, which will be included in this event, positively, a very important part of the subject. But we're interested in bringing forth another part of the subject a little bit more strongly than usual, which is has to do with the effects upon the natural world and the effects upon nature in ourselves. In other words, there's two parts to that nature story. It's both the external world outside of ourselves and also the internal world of our thoughts and feelings and attitudes and worldview. So the first section will be called Technology versus Nature, and it's going to review the state of the planet at the moment. In other words, the planet is in terrible, terrible shape, running out of resources, we're running out of even fresh water, and all of that is because of change of climate and change of pollution patterns and continued economic growth of corporations. And then we'll get into some of the basic worldview situations. You know, currently there's a lot of play for the term anthropocentrism, which basically is advocating that human beings are supposed to be in charge of nature, that we're as gods to nature. Mm-hmm. And this has become popular in a certain circle.
Mm-hmm.
And that therefore we've just got to take charge of the situation and run nature and run the world and try to do a better job of it if we can. But basically it's our job to do it rather than backing off into another set of more in ways of relating to nature that are more benign and supportive and rather than
exactly
dominant.
Supportive.
And that's so anthropocentrism will be the root of that, and some people will want to go back to the Enlightenment to find the roots of some of this, and some of it will go back to the birth of capitalism and so on, and we'll cover it that way. And then a third panel.
And then wait, I'm going to show a way out. Fair disclosure, folks, I am one of the many speakers.
Sure.
At this
Tell
weekend.
Us what you're going to
so
do.
So I'm going to talk about dynamic interrelatedness, as my listeners will not be surprised to learn, as a way of developing discernment on how to think about new technologies.
Right.
Okay, then, so the next
subsection. Then there'll be a lot of talk about nature itself. From some people who really are studying the situation, are connecting with the wild, and want to talk about what's happening in wild nature, and how to reclaim that, and how to make a new relationship to that, and that'll include people like Wes Jackson and Dave Foreman and David Ehrenfeld and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mention some of the names on the first panel. Richard Heinberg will be one of the people on the first panel. Andy Kimbrell, Ralph White, Charlene, and so on. I guess I won't name too many people.
That gives people an idea.
Yeah. And part
and
two is what's called technological solutionism, and this is a very important aspect of this event. It's the idea that technology, which may have caused all these problems, is also going to solve all these problems. And,
right. Right, the problems of the last technological fix can be solved by the next technological fix.
That's right. The idea of backing off from that whole way of doing things is, of course, never included in the discussion. So it's technological solutionism, building substitute nature, in other words, new nature.
Right.
As I listed, we'll have panels on geoengineering, which is the one that will make the new skies for us, and nanotechnology will create a new planet. Genetic redesign, create new people. Synthetic biology, new other living beings. And GMOs, we're already battling GMOs and EMFs. So those are some of the main subjects. And then there'll be a very good panel on that Helen Caldicott will be on nuclear energy. And then we'll also move on into some of the new military technologies that are becoming upon us. The drones and robotics are really beginning to dominate military, so the war was going to be without soldiers. And all of these things are always sold to us as, like nuclear energy was sold to us as being for the good of mankind. You know, that's how they introduced the first A-bomb was, this is going to be ultimately for the good of mankind because this energy is going to be so beneficial. I'm sure Helen will have more to say about that.
And too cheap to meet her.
Beg pardon?
And too cheap to meet her. Remember that story?
Oh, yeah, too cheap to meet her.
Too cheap to meet her.
Well,
by the way, let's break in here with that news story from last week about the costs of the nuclear waste underground storage facility near Carlsbad, New Mexico. It's in that old salt formation.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And one of the drums, the metal drums from Los Alamos, just exploded several months ago. They don't know
and
why.
They have no idea why, either.
They won't say what was in it. And then another part of the salt cave formation, there was the fire. That's right. There was a fire with a truck that was down under there. So what they're going to try that now, they say, has never been tested. They're going to spray water up and melt part of the salt ceiling and hope that kind of freezes things and do something and then spray some more water. And they also say that the budget, this repository won't be open to receive more waste until 2016, but the budget for taking care of these two accidents already exceeds several years' worth of what was budgeted in. So it's pretty much way beyond, of course, what, as usual, the promises
were.
We'll
be dealing with that economic situation in that panel also on nuclear technology, drones, and robots, and so on, for the good of mankind. And we'll have, by the way, a very interesting speaker from the Marshall Islands, an older woman who was actually there when they dropped the first atomic bomb on Bikini.
Oh.
And we'll describe the consequences of that and what it all meant for the people and what's going on now. It's extremely interesting. And that panel will have, besides Helen, you know, several people, real experts on nuclear energy. The previous one, by the way, will have Clive Hamilton, who's been leading the climate battle for a very, very, very long time from Australia. And I highly recommend him. I could name all these people, but I don't think that. And then that
I'm evening, sure he'll mention that there's certainly a lot of, it's not at all a monolithic endorsement of this, that a lot of scientists have say this geoengineering would probably make things way worse.
No, that's true of all these things. All
yeah,
these solutions,
course.
That's the point of it.
But
they're
I mean,
building,
people, scientific people
nature.
Saying this is too wild. Well, I don't mean wild in the sense that we use it. I mean, this is too bizarre.
Yeah. Well, you know, the point is that it's an economic point. You know, the planet, you know, capitalism depends upon having constant flow of resources and constant flow of economic growth. And once you've used up all the resources and destroyed the planet, which makes it impossible to keep growing at the same rate, you've got to sort of build a new planet. And that's what most of these technologies are trying to do. They're trying to rebuild a resource base that they can then exploit all over again by new sky,
oh.
new earth, new people, new food, you know, and so on. Each one
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, I get it. Okay.
And then finally that evening, we're going to have Ralph Nader, who's still a very remarkable, wonderful, interesting speaker, and probably Bill McKibben. I don't have a final okay on him, but I'm pretty sure we have Bill McKibben on Saturday night as well.
Great.
So
okay, let's move
on
to the second day. Sunday, October 26th, part three is about cyber envelope and human experience. Oh, I'm sorry, cyber envelopment and human experience.
Yeah, we may call it Life Inside the Machine, the first panel, because what we're trying to get at is that cyber technology, sort of like advertising and sort of like mass media itself, but even more so, accelerates the rate in which we are actually living inside a framework of imagery and expressions that are mainly corporate expressions, although sometimes not. But the point is that we're living inside a set of deliberately created communication. You know, it's in our brains, it's in us, and we completely. I mean, all you have to do is walk down the street now and see how many people you almost bump into from walking at you with their iPads as they're as they're walking down the street. People, we have really merged with cyber technology. You know, to even a greater degree than we merged with the previous round of technological activity. And
absolutely.
We'll have Langdon Winner on that panel, who wrote the magnificent book Autonomous Technology, and Douglas Rushkoff, who wrote a very interesting book called Present Shock. It's like we're all in a state of shock from all of this. Aidan Enns, who publishes a terrific magazine on all this, and it's called G's Magazine, G-E-E-Z, and they're doing a special issue on life offline. And I think Winona LaDuke will be on that panel, I'm pretty sure. So
Wait, before you go on, I'm just wondering, one of the things you said early on when I heard you speak so many years ago about this, you said, yes, you know, people would hold up their hands, but it lets all the grassroots groups communicate with each other. It's just wonderful for organizing. You said, yes, it is. However, weigh that against the enormous powers of surveillance. Everything you do online can be tracked, and we didn't really understand that way back when. Is someone addressing that here?
You know, I think that will be addressed in that panel. I actually don't know which speaker is going to do that, but we have talked about that. It will certainly be addressed, for sure.
Okay.
And it's very important, as you point out, that no one denies that there are benefits to these things. Otherwise, they would have, you know, each individual technology that comes along is offering something.
Right.
And the question is, what's the trade-off on it each time? Because what you get to hear is the upside of the story, and it takes 30 years or 20 years before you realize that EMF radiation causes cancer in a lot of people, et cetera. You know, that each technology has a downside.
Right.
And what we're trying to say is it's time to look at the downside primarily, because look at the state of things. It hasn't improved the world. It's made the world worse in many respects, and it certainly caused great health problems and ecological problems.
And also the effect of raising children on a glowing screen in their formative years,
exactly,
when their brains really, right, according to evolution, need other kinds of stimulus.
So can we talk about this? You know, so that's what we're going to be trying. We're going to try to present a one-sided story that has been left out of the story. So one-sided negative story. So then the panel after that will be begins to get into where we go from here. You know, what the ingredients of change ought to be, and one will be, you know, we outline a rough set of principles: the importance of scale, small, you know, not large scale, small scale, not globalization, localization, not faster, slower, not more or less, not top down, bottom up, et cetera, et cetera. A long list of principles that we might adopt, and these will be discussed in three different panels.
Mm-hmm.
The first on globalization and localization. That will have Vandana Shiva on it,
mm-hmm,
great Indian activist who's a very, very brilliant presenter, and mm-hmm, Helena Norberg-Hodge, who will discuss the economics of happiness. And we also have Severin Bantarsha Fleming, who's doing a remarkable job organizing young farmers who don't want to become part of corporate farming,
mm-hmm,
but who do want to operate farms and grow vegetables and live in that manner close to nature. And there are thousands of them now. They're just, mm-hmm, growing in great numbers. And so she's got an organization called Greenhorns, which helps small young farmers with very little capital establish how to get control of some land enough to start a farm and then help them organize together. It's very, very, very interesting.
Uh-huh.
And then
we'll
have to move on here.
What?
Excuse me?
Yeah, we have to...
We're running out of time.
Well, we have enough time, but... So at the end of that panel, there's this wonderful Luddite puppet theater show I'm looking forward to, and then you move into the panel on sustaining indigenous values.
Right. We'll have several indigenous people from indigenous cultures who are in the midst of this battle. Of course, they're trying to talk about a worldview that is the opposite of this. And we'll have some very articulate people, Jeanette Armstrong.
And we should say it's the grandparent of all our worldviews, which moved away from it in the Western modern world. But this is how, for so long, we respected and engaged with nature.
But it's very important that we find out what the principles are that they live by. You know,
right,
in order to, if we're going to do anything about trying to emulate that.
And restore
and,
balance. Right.
So we'll have several very articulate people. Jeanette Armstrong is absolutely marvelous. She's an Okanagan from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
She's very good at articulating these things. And we'll have a Quechua woman from Ecuador, and they're busy trying to keep the oil in the ground and so that their community is not destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Winona LaDuke will also be part of that panel.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to do a session on... the rights of nature. This is a new movement that's developing in the country to try to actually codify, to give power to nature, which doesn't have it. It's all about people arguing with each other, our legal system. But they want to establish what rights can we establish that could be honored in our court system.
Mm-hmm.
And Linda Sheehan, who's a fantastic lawyer, will be speaking about codifying the rights of nature, and that will be extremely interesting too, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, we're just going to talk about hybrid economics. You know, there's...
hybrid economics. Yeah.
Hybrid economics.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, everybody says, well, if you're not for capitalism, what are you for? You know?
Yeah.
And often that stops the conversation because...
Because
you can't blurt out, you know, a new system that doesn't have its own... You know, nobody in this crowd is in favor of communism. You know, there's various parts of socialism,
right,
that look okay. There's,
right,
various parts of anarchism that look okay. There's various parts of capitalism that look okay. So it's just like, how do you restructure something so it has the right principles that operate it and drops out the wrong stuff? So the main principles that... I always write about are, you know, four main principles. Nature has to be protected. That's number one. The scale, scale is prime. It has to be small scale, not global, not local. You can't have...
We're about out of time, so go
ahead.
We're
about out of time. Okay, so
we'll
we've got to restructure corporations and got to think of it as hybrid systems.
Okay. And
anyway,
on this panel on hybrid economics, besides yourself, Richard Heinberg will be speaking, Randy Hayes, and Andrew Kimbrell again, and Wes Jackson. So, wow. I really hope people living in or near New York can make it, because this really will help you think about technology in ways that are out from under the thumb of the ubiquitous marketing departments. That's all the time we have, but Jerry Mander, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Charlene, and I look forward to seeing you there.
Okay.
You know, we don't have final answers there, but we have good processes that we're going to work on together.
That's right, and because of all your efforts, so thanks a lot for that.
All right.
Okay, we will break now, pause for the break, after which my second guest today will be Dr. Helen Caldicott. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Let's give them something to talk about, babe. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. As promised, my guest for the second half of the program is Dr. Helen Caldicott. She'll be in New York next month to speak at the teach-in on techno-utopianism and the fate of the Earth. That's at Cooper Union on October 25th and 26th. Helen Caldicott is an Australian physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate who has founded several associations dedicated to opposing the use of nuclear power and nuclear weapons, including, during the peace movement of the early 1980s, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the wonderful Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, which was known as WAND. She's been the subject of award-winning documentary films and is the author of many books, including If You Love This Planet and Nuclear Madness, What You Can Do, and Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. She has a very informative website, HelenCaldicott.com, and also one run by her foundation at NuclearFreePlanet.org. Now, I'd like to add to all that, that I heard Helen Caldicott give a talk in, I think it was the fall of 1984, when I was back in Columbus, Ohio, visiting family. It was a very Republican audience of businessmen and women, nearly all of whom, most likely, supported President Reagan strongly in his massive arms buildup. Until that afternoon, Dr. Caldicott skillfully cut through the political dividing lines by assessing the situation of our having 30,000 nuclear warheads aimed at the Soviets and their having 20,000 aimed at us. She diagnosed the symptoms, the causes, and the cure for this deadly malady facing the human species. It was an extremely impressive and effective speech, and I could see why at that point. She was responsible for waking up hundreds of thousands of people to the imminent dangers of the government policy known as mutually assured destruction. Dr. Helen Caldicott, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I know you've been tracking the aftermath of the Fukushima disaster, which I very much want to hear about. But first, a rather shocking report was released a few days ago by the Congressional Budget Office that reveals the extensive and very expensive so-called modernization of our nuclear weapons labs and facilities by President Obama. And that report estimates that this upgrading, expanding, and modernizing will cost $355 billion over the first decade. And then other studies estimate that it will cost over $1 trillion over three decades. So there are about 16,300 nuclear weapons now. They're located at 98 sites in 14 countries, the vast majority of them in the United States and Russia. So according to the New START Treaty with Moscow, Russia and the United States are mutually committed to reduce the number of its deployed strategic nuclear weapons to 1,550 on each side by February 2018. The Obama administration says that their vast upgrading and expanding of our 8 nuclear weapons facilities is the way to reach that goal of reduction. I mean, that does seem possible, but not probable. And then there's the additional problem that there is a concomitant reduction in the president's proposed budget on spending on nuclear security, a reduction, security at sites here and abroad. And that's, of course, very worrisome. So, Helen Caldicott, what's your response to this extensive program to modernize our nuclear weapons facilities?
Well, speaking as a physician, I would say that it's psychopathic. It's sick. The whole government, which supports such a notion, or many of them, because they've been bought and sold by the military-industrial complex, either are scientifically illiterate, or they say that creating more nuclear weapons, more submarines, ships, planes, and the like will increase jobs in their district. And I'm going to use an analogy which people might not like, but I'm sure Hitler said the same about building his gas ovens, only this is creating the possible global gas oven. We're in serious, serious trouble. In the 1980s, 80% of Americans opposed the concept of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We were really ready for bilateral nuclear disarmament with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And George I actually got rid of, unilaterally, of some of the weapons to support Gorbachev bringing all the weapons back from the Ukraine and the like back to Russia. Then Bill Clinton came into office, and he left all the weapons in place and didn't really work with Russia for abolition of nuclear weapons. Now, he could have achieved that had he had the courage, wisdom, and tenacity, because President Yeltsin was a totally compliant president, a very severe alcoholic, and if Clinton had gotten Air Force One and flown to Moscow with a treaty and said, Boris, it's time we abolish nuclear weapons, there's a precedent here because Reagan and Gorbachev in Reykjavik in 89 or 88 almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons in their country.
Mm-hmm.
Would you please sign this agreement? Therefore, if we have a nuclear holocaust tonight because of the increasing tension and anxiety in Ukraine, when for the first time since the Cold War, Russia and America are actually confronting each other again, and it's quite possible their nuclear missiles are now on a higher state of alert, it will be Bill Clinton's legacy. It simply amazes me that power that the military-industrial complex has in this country. This country now makes very little. Most of the stuff people buy is made of in China. But it certainly makes guns, but it makes nuclear weapons and things to kill people. In the nuclear age, it's time that men stopped killing. It's time we stopped killing, for if we don't, almost certainly, nuclear weapons will be used. There are at least 40 H-bombs targeted on New York City as I speak, probably 60 on Washington, 60 on Moscow. Such a redundancy of weapons. Every time a city with a population of 50,000 or more is targeted, colleges, universities, industries, the whole thing. And the country will burn north and south, east and west, and so will Europe and Russia and China and England and Australia and Canada, creating a huge pall of toxic radioactive smoke, covering the earth with a cloud so thick it blocks out the sun for up to 10 years, inducing a short ice age and the end of most life on earth. So we're actually talking about annihilating ourselves,
mm-hmm,
and paying for it with our tax dollars. It's socialized annihilation.
Well, listening to you makes me see how we really need to rev up the whole public education campaign again, because this is just not well understood. Well, I want to move into the other big area because of our limited time frame here, and that, of course, is the aftermath of the Fukushima disaster, which I know you've been tracking. It's increasingly understood to be the greatest industrial accident in the Earth's history. And I had a lot of problems at the time it happened trying to convince colleagues at the institute where I was teaching. I said, this isn't just a terribly unfortunate thing that happened in Japan. This is a planetary event. And it just didn't seem to register that way. But you yourself organized a two-day symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine last year on the medical and ecological consequences of Fukushima, where some of the world's leading scientists, epidemiologists, physicists, and physicians presented their latest data and findings. So what are the ongoing effects of that disaster?
Oh, well, just to say that a book coming out from the proceedings of that conference called Crisis Without End is about to be published any day by the New Press, so you can read about it. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a total and absolute disaster. There were three meltdowns, actual meltdowns, in three nuclear power plants. The fuel weighs about 100 tons. It's full of the most deadly radioactive elements known to humans, all created by humans. The reactors were built in front of a mountain range, and water pours down from the mountains beneath the reactors into the sea. But now that the cores of 100 tons each of molten uranium and their isotopes have melted into the ground, possibly, or broken through the containment vessel, hundreds of tons of water a day are washing over those cores, becoming hugely contaminated. So every day, 300 to 400 tons of very radioactive water are pouring into the Pacific. What people may not know is that radiation elements concentrate, biomagnify in the food chain, like hundreds of thousands of times in the algae, then hundreds of thousands of times in the into the little fish, and then more into the big fish, and finally into us. Cesium, strontium, plutonium, uranium, all sorts of elements. And then you don't taste, smell, or see these elements. You don't know the food that you're eating is radioactive. Fish swim thousands of miles. There's a big plume of very radioactive water heading towards the west coast of the United States at this time. The ambient levels of radiation in Seattle after the accident went up 40,000 times above normal. And indeed, much of the west coast was blanketed with some radiation, and radioactive elements were found even in Boston and also in Europe. Two of the buildings were very, very unstable. It's an earthquake greater than 700 Richter scale. Building 3 could well collapse, which was an absolute calamitous result, with Tokyo probably being irradiated and much of the northern hemisphere. As building 4 collapses, a similar event could occur. There are over 1,000 huge tanks containing highly radioactive water that were built on a temporary basis. They would collapse to pouring their radiation into the sea. No one can get near these molten cores, otherwise they would die from radiation sickness. And there is no way, I think, known to the human race, let alone physicists, to alleviate the situation. It will be ongoing, I think, for over 100 years or longer, because there's no way they can get this material, get to it, or remove it from where it is. So we're sitting on a radioactive volcanic time bomb, which has no end in sight.
Let me ask you, not only as a planetary figure who's so well informed here, but a resident of another country, is there more awareness of this in Australia than in the United States? I mean, you're a Pacific Rim country.
No. In fact, the uranium in the reactors was Australian uranium, so we're going to be responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of people. Already, 103 children under the age of 18 in the Fukushima prefecture have developed thyroid cancer. The incidence of thyroid cancer in that age group is 1 to 2 per million, and that's the tip of the iceberg. It means they must have got a very high dose of radiation to their thyroids from radioactive iodine and cesium, but this indicates that there will be a huge number of cancers in the exposed population over the next, 50, 80 years and beyond that, because the food in Fukushima, much of it is radioactive. They're diluting radioactive rice with non-radioactive rice to make it less polluted, but they're eating it, they're selling it to countries abroad. I've read that they're canning very radioactive food and sending it to developing nations. Mitsubishi cars, second-hand cars going to Moscow, found to be extremely radioactive. Do not buy a second-hand Japanese car from Japan. I mean, I can go on and on, but I know the Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, who spoke at my conference, who was in charge at the time, it was so severe that they were thinking of evacuating Tokyo, 50 million people. Well, you can't evacuate Tokyo. But that is still on the cards because the earthquakes occur in that area almost continuously, and there are large ones and small ones, yes.
Right. Amazing that they're building new plants in that, on an island in that area.
Don't eat any Japanese food, seaweed, miso soup, fish in particular, rice, anything imported from Japan, do not eat it.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And Hillary Clinton signed an agreement just after the accident with the Japanese people that America would keep importing Japanese food, and that has not changed.
Huh. Wow. Do you see any areas of where there's an acknowledgement of this? It seems like there's such denial.
Well, it's a huge cover-up. I mean, the Japanese people are very interesting. They're very, they all follow the leader.
Yeah.
And they don't speak out. The women in particular rose up, particularly those with children, because women intuitively know how dangerous this is. Children are 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults. They get cancer much more readily. It's been shown children living in nuclear reactors have a much higher than normal incidence of leukemia and cancer, so don't live near a nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
That's the normally operating one. But the ordinary people of Japan, that they're intimidated, and Abe, the new Prime Minister, has passed the law to say that you're not allowed to talk about this, and in fact, if you do, you might go to jail for 10 years.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Okay. We're out of time, Helen, but oh my gosh, I just feel this has just been such an education in a short amount of time, as always, listening to you.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for all the work you do, and thank you for coming on the program. And so we arrive at the closing moments of my co-hosting All Together Now. When I began this program in April 2012, my book, Relational Reality, was just about to be published. That book presents scores of surprising discoveries made in just the past dozen years, mostly about how the human body-mind really works, that is, scores of medical and other scientific discoveries about the fact that we are actually structured and function in dynamic interrelationship with other people and with the presence of nature. I call the totality of these recent discoveries and the ways in which so many of them have moved right into the mainstream, I call that the relational shift. And after the book was published, I wanted to keep learning about this relational shift that's changing nearly all the fields of learning, really, and so many of our institutions, such as, for example, the way hospital rooms are designed now, often with large pictures of mountain scenes that the patient, right across from the patient's bed, because these have been found to aid in our healing process. So I made the relational shift the focus of this program. And during the past 2.5 years, I've been able to have on-air conversations with pioneers of relational psychology and psychotherapy, the relational factors in cultivating resiliency in children, the wellness movement, eco-literacy, the movement for community-based economies, the relational worldview of Dr. Martin Luther King, the relational perspective in community design, the relational thought of Leonardo da Vinci, the relational approach of restorative justice, a relational ecological sense of democracy, a relational perspective on children's mental health, relational approaches in treating post-traumatic stress disorder among veterans, and many other topics drawing from the growing awareness that dynamic interrelatedness lies at the heart of every situation. I've learned so much from speaking with my guests on this program, but there are so many new discoveries about dynamic interrelatedness that keep being made and announced every month that no one could fit all of it into any one radio program. Since the book Relational Reality was published, I've kept seeing articles about these new studies and clipping them, and I now have a big file of this sort of discoveries. And I started a Facebook page that's titled Relational Reality when the book first came out, and I posted there, I think it's 10 examples of these new discoveries. And I didn't do anything more until this fall when I decided to share brief descriptions of all the studies I've collected. In other words, to continue what's in the book, because this is a big breaking story. So I've been posting one of these studies every few days so that people can see the array across different fields and they can connect the dots. Because taken together, these discoveries comprise the relational shift now occurring. So even though my exploration of this huge topic via this program is ending today, I invite you, if you're interested, to visit the Facebook page about relational reality. And also, if you happen to see an article in the media about a medical or other scientific discovery of some new occurrence that was unknown before of dynamic interrelatedness, you're very welcome to post it on that Facebook page and expand the conversation. One other project I'd like to tell you about. A month from now, on October 23rd, Palgrave Macmillan in New York will publish a book I've been working on for many years. The title is The Spiritual Dynamic in Modern Art, Art History Reconsidered, 1800 to the Present. This book presents the unknown stories of the spiritual interests of scores of famous modern artists, both historical and contemporary, and the ways in which those spiritual interests influenced the radical new art forms they created. These findings counter the dominant narrative in art history and the art world that modern art is an almost entirely secular body of work. Actually, that's not true. I found that the majority of the most celebrated modern artists had spiritual and/or religious interests that were central to their art. So I researched and composed their spiritual biographies for the first time using their direct statements about their spiritual interests. And those are all gathered in this new book, The Spiritual Dynamic in Modern Art. So thank you so much for joining me on All Together Now. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Beginning next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will become the sole host of this program with a focus on transformational politics. This has been Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.